Hello, my name is Brad McIntyre, and you're listening to the Cultivated Playwright Podcast, Episode 22. So welcome back to part two of Inside Lou and Davis. This is a two-part podcast, this being the second part, of a conversation I had with a good friend of mine and fellow artist, Jeff Hernandez. We both sat down and watched the Coen Brothers movie, Inside Lou and Davis, and then talked about it. That's what this podcast is about, is us talking about it. In this second part, we talk about what the cat means, the symbolism of the cat that goes in and out of the movie that Oscar Isaac's Llewyn Davis carries around. We also talk about, in a wider scope, the notion of selling out and what actually is success. Llewyn Davis does not actually attain success in the movie, even though he is a highly, highly skilled musician and singer. And puts on some of the better performances in the movie. One gets the sense that even though he is equipped technically to be successful, emotionally and psychologically, he sabotages himself and can't attain success. And that's kind of one of the takeaways of the movie. So sit back and buckle in and all that jazz and listen to part two of Inside Llewyn Davis. Bob Dylan played the game.
Yeah.
Bob Dylan is the personification of trying to keep it real, but also making all the deals.
Yeah.
Like he, in real life, he surpassed folk music. And Llewyn Davis would never be that guy.
Yeah. He's just barely a side note.
Right.
I mean, a fictional right. side note.
Now, I will say this, like watching the movie the first time, I was like, he's just as good as Bob Dylan, if not better, like in the movie.
Yeah.
And that would kind of cemented it. Now, the second time through, I was like, that Bob Dylan song's pretty good. At the end of the movie, I was like, that Bob Dylan song's pretty good. And lyrically, all the songs are matching what's happening in the scenes.
Yeah.
Like he sings a song about shipping off to different places to his dad, who's like a legend in the Merchant Marines. Everybody keeps asking, are you so-and-so son?
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, that's my dad.
You Al Davis's
son? Yeah, Al Davis's son. And he can't live down the legacy of his father.
Yes.
And he can't connect with his father, but he does connect with the music. The music allows him to connect with his dad. And I think that that Gene has a crush on him, not because of the person he is, but how he plays music.
Yeah.
It's like he has a secret, like a superpower, and doesn't know how to use it.
Well, he's still a musician. I mean, and he's still Oscar Isaac. So, like, that stuff makes sense, I guess, in my head, like, where I'm just like, girls will fall, you know, like.
Oh, you mean like in real life?
In real life, he's, you know, like, the character would definitely be getting laid no matter what. Like, he would be like. He's still handsome. He still plays music.
He's a musician. Do you have to be a good person girls as a musician?
Yeah, no, he's definitely going to try to score. He needs a place to crash anyway. So, like, he's homeless.
The ethos of the bad boy in music?
Yeah, exactly. So, he's gonna try to hit up anything that, well, whatever. Yeah, but I definitely found him more of a, which is interesting because of a cautionary tale, which is when you talk about doing a series of these, like looking at all these movies with like artists, I think for the most part, artists are portrayed as like, especially in movies, if they're well known well enough to have something, a different art form spring up and try to, you know, tell the story of an artist. Like they're generally tortured, bucolic asshole kind of people, as you know, like you throw out, you know, Pollock is another movie of like a like he was a drunkard artist, and you know, like,
oh, the myth of the struggling
of like the kind of type A,
like temperamental, yeah, angsty, artisty type of person.
But usually they're, you know, like, and even in not like with like traditional artists, but like Steve Jobs or whatever, like they're these kind of type A, like big, and you can see like the payoff is they were successful.
Yeah, yeah. But surviving Picasso, one, Modigliani,
yeah,
Basquiat, all those like painter movies.
Yeah, but in this one, he's not a success. He's like all ego, bucolic, artsy, artistic-y person, that stereotype, but he is also a loser in the end. Like, he just, it doesn't work
by virtue that he loses.
Yeah.
Like, he does not gain.
All he does is alienate people because he's not, you know, singular enough.
Yeah. And it's telling too. It's like he's trying to reinvent himself and has no idea what he wants to be.
That's where, so the if you are not a singular enough artist that you don't have like a goal or whatever, so if you're just this guy, Gorgrel or whatever, and you're like, I have this idea of what the art should be, like I am committed to it, I will not sell out, you know, like Llewyn Davis does in the movie. But my question is, what is the end goal there? Because he's jealous of the more successful people, but he looks down upon the way they go about being successful. So I'm like, if in real life, my question is, what is success to you? Because success would be, well, people just adore me for what I am. But I'm like, but then you have to, for me, I'm like, you're not good enough for that. Like, you are not good enough.
Are you talking about you, Jeff?
No, well, Llewyn Davis.
Oh, okay.
That's what I would tell him.
Oh, okay. Jeff's having problems with his headphones.
Yeah.
It's Beats by Dre. Yeah. He doesn't define what is successful. In fact, his lack of definition is like the major thing about him. This time through, that's what I picked up on the most.
Yeah.
Is the fact that he's just drifting along. He seems to be in mourning for he's carrying grief for his partner.
Yeah.
But also like grief for the career that he'll never have with that partner, as well as his old partner, Timlin. I forgot the guy's name. Mike Timlin was the name of the character, who's voiced by the lead singer of the Mumford & Sons, by the way. When you hear the recording from the record that they did together, it's the guy from Mumford & Sons. But he's mourning that. He can't seem to shake his past. People keep trying to give him pieces of his past, and he keeps trying to throw it away.
Yeah.
Like his agent keeps boxes of old records of his that they've had to clear out the storeroom, and they just give him this box. And he's basically homeless. He doesn't even have where to keep it. And then he goes to his sister, and she's like, I've collected all these things. And he's like, just throw them out. I don't need them.
Yeah.
And of course, he explicitly does need them later in the movie, his cavalier attitude. And then past mistakes, he doesn't face up to any of them.
Yeah.
When he realizes that the girl from earlier in his past had a baby and didn't go through with the abortion, and he realizes he has a son and that she lives in Akron, Ohio, and he kind of intimates that he knows where she is, like he knows where her parents live.
Yeah.
And on the way back from Chicago, he's driving basically, John Goodman's passed out in the back seat, but he's mostly by himself. And he could pull off the...
Yeah, this is on his way back from Chicago.
Yeah, he, on the exit ramp.
He hitches a ride. The guy falls, like,
Oh, that's right. That's right. You're right. You're correct. On the way back, he ditches the car that has
John Goodman
in it, because Johnny Five falls asleep and swerves a little bit, and the cops pull him over, and because of the way Johnny Five looks and his attitude, they basically like, get out. They just haul him in.
Yeah, they just arrest him.
In a wonderful, it's very Coen's Brothers-y kind of thing of like a system just overtaking an individual just Kafka-esquely out of the blue. But he's left alone in the car, and he gets out of the car and hitches a ride, and the guy's like, if you drive... Is that right?
Yeah, so he's leaving Chicago, going back to New York. He hitches a ride with a guy who was like, I'm trying to get back to New Jersey, and I need somebody to help me drive because he's going to fall asleep in this car. And so he's Llewyn Davis is driving, and the guy whose car it is
just sleeping in the front seat. And there's an exit for Akron, Ohio.
And he drives right.
And it looks for a moment like he might exit.
Yeah.
And you know what he's looking at when he looks at the sign. You know what's there as the viewer of the film, and he doesn't do it. He passes by it. And just right after that, a cat darts across the road and he hits it. And it looks just like the yellow cat.
Yeah, the cat that's been...
The cat that's been hovering in the background the whole movie. The one that gets lost from the apartment. The wrong one, so to speak, that he takes to live with his girlfriend for a little bit. And it even comes with him on the way to Chicago. But he ultimately ditches that cat. But then this other cat that looks identical... And he swerves out of the way and he can't avoid hitting it. Like, he hits it. And it's shown on the side of the road. And I have to say, the cinematography in this movie is beautiful, but there are some parts that are so dark.
Yeah.
Which is wonderful thematically. Like, as a metaphor, darkness creeps in on this guy in every frame.
Yeah. It's a very grayed out blue movie.
Yeah. It's telling that he's most at home momentarily. He's most comfortable in the spotlight, on a darkened stage, in a darkened room.
Yeah.
But they show a shot of the cat on the side of the road, and I could barely make it out. I was like, what is he looking at? Like, it's so dark. It was lit so little, but he hits it, and the cat itself is kind of a weird metaphor. Yeah. I kept thinking to myself, is the cat him? Is he the cat? Or is the cat like him trying to let go of his friend? Is the cat represent his grief? Is the cat represent his luck? You know how like the black cat myth of like or lucky cat in Asian cultures, the little cats with the hands that yeah. dart forward for prosperity. I was like, do cats equal fortune? Now it's not helpful.
Egyptian cat?
The Coen brothers totally mix this stuff up all the time, and they never tell you what they actually were thinking.
Yeah.
And it's never very, they're always super subtle and open-ended on all of their symbolism in their movies. But I don't know. What did you think the cat was?
On set. And I think they let's just throw it in the movie.
They just found a cat?
Yeah. Let's just do it. Well, I don't know. I didn't really, what would the cat represent? Yeah. I think it just mirrors his fortune. I don't know. I didn't really. I was not prepared for that question.
I'm sorry.
I'll come back.
Sorry. The cat haunted me. When I saw this movie again with you, I didn't pay attention to the cat the first time. But now, in the years since this came out, I have been teaching introduction to cinema classes like quite a bit. And I have doubled down on my playwriting quite a bit since 2014. And I have become a student of the metaphor, so to speak. And I really freaking love Coen Brothers movies. They make the kind of movies that I like super geek out about. And even when I don't necessarily quote unquote like the movie, I still can't deny their movies are like super, super layered. Like they're onions of movies.
I feel like the cat is something. I feel like the cat is like a, it's almost like just a split second of foreshadowing in the movie. So like every, because you see what's going to happen.
When the window opened, even when we were watching it, he opened the fire escape window.
Yeah, every single
time. And you're like, that cat's going to get out. And then like within seconds, the cat gets out.
In the beginning of the movie, he's leaving his friend's upper, you know, west side apartment, very fancy. And he opens the door. And my first thought was like, that cat's going to bolt. Like, it's almost like the cat is like the world around him. And he is so singularly focused on just himself. Like, he doesn't pay attention to what's going on until it's, like, already too late. The cat's already out of the apartment. Now he's got to go chase after the cat. Instead of just being conscious in the moment, being like, oh, I better not let the cat out. Like, just being aware of his surroundings.
Yeah.
So, like, and then later in the, he's staying with, what's her name's apartment? Jean's apartment. And he's eating cereal on the couch next to the open window. And the cat slowly strolls up to me. And he's like talking to the cat. He's like, hey, buddy. And I'm like, the cat, the window, close the thing. And he just like, the cat just runs out. And so then he goes out and then he tries to pass off a random street cat that he found.
Yeah, that looks alike. It looks like the other cat.
It's like an orange tabby cat. He finds a random street cat and tries to return that to the
fiend. Admittedly, he thinks it's the same cat.
He does think it's the same
cat. But the owners know it's not the same cat.
It's a different gender.
Yeah. When he gets back to the Gorfines, they're like, that's not our cat.
Yeah. But he does find out beforehand that it's a... On a phone call, he finds out that the sex of the cat. But he never... I mean, I don't know. I don't know what a cat penis looks like. I don't know. But I would have closed the door. So, like...
Which I have to say, I really love the line because it's a classic Coen Brothers delivery where the Mrs. Gorfine says, "Where are its testicles, Lewin?" She's holding the cat up, butt in towards him, like just the underside of the cat facing him.
Yeah, when they find out it's not their cat.
She's like, "It's not our cat. Where are the testicles, Lewin?"
He ends up stranded with the street cat.
Yeah.
And when he goes to Chicago, the street cat, he takes the street cat with him. And then when he abandons the car, he abandons the cat.
Yes.
And there's like a lot of like this kind of like, you can see like it's just him shirking responsibility. Like he gets in these messes. He didn't have to bring the cat along. He brought the cat along and then he just abandons the cat. The cat is just like every bad decision, either in coming up or like it's just, you know, it's just the reminder of like this guy keeps making the wrong choices. Yeah. Like he makes the irresponsible choices, the selfish choices.
Yeah, he and it's telling that it's the point in the movie where he decides to give up his quote unquote career. Mm-hmm. Like maybe the cat is symbolizing his career, like,
yeah,
and it's just on the run from him. Like it's just he can't quite grasp it. It never finds its home,
yeah,
so to speak, and it just kind of floats around out there. It's telling in a wonderfully spot on way that they name the cat Ulysses. Did you find out at the end of the movie? It's like the cat's, and he even says it. Lou Davis even looks at the Gorfines and he's like, "Your cat's name is Ulysses. That's his name." Like even he's not oblivious to the circular nature of this drifting journey. Like, but yeah, the cat was a big part of it, and I don't know what the cat means. I don't definitively know, but I can see it being a stand-in for his career. Like when he kind of mortally wounds it on the side of the road,
yeah,
you think to yourself, oh, well, that maybe he's going to lay that guitar down. And by the end of the movie, you realize, nope, he's just going to circularly be caught in this limbo stage for who knows how long.
So like when you say, this is like a horror movie. Like, for me, I'm like, it still is a horror movie, but it's, like, the part that is the, like, it's the, don't go have sex in the woods. It's, like, the, don't be this, it's the...
Let's split up.
Yeah.
Like, in an actual horror movie.
Yeah,
They do those horror tropes of, now's a good time to have sex in a car.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, when the killer's on the loose. Doing?
What are you, what? It's a cautionary tale kind of thing, where you're like, no, don't.
I believe there's something... I do believe there's something to it. I believe there's something to my original thought of it. I really do believe there are people who live, create, and die without making a mark on the world, even though they do produce things that are pound for pound better. There are people that probably have existed who make things of higher quality that could be more impactful, but they don't do the second part of the equation. They don't connect with people.
Yeah.
They don't play the game of getting their stuff out into the world. I personally live in Dallas, Texas, and for years I joked around that I've been doing theater for years, but nobody knows who I am. And it was like this kind of bittersweet truth joke that I would bring up from time to time. But the hard fact is there's a lot of people in Dallas that are probably making theater that are on the same level as I am, and not just Dallas, like the whole country, the whole world, but that work hard and just never are in the right place at the right time, that haven't broken through. And it's especially more infuriating when people do break through that from one's own standpoint are not as good, have not paid as many dues, don't have something genuine to say, but somehow get an audience, somehow connect.
Yeah.
Like the connection outweighs their ability to make art.
Yeah.
And the realization is, this time through, I picked up on it much more. And I'm also older and life's beat me down enough. I don't know because I'm me, but I would like to say I'm not as full of myself as I used to be. It's hard to comment on that accurately because I'm me. But in this movie, the people that are around him are talented enough. Like,
yeah,
they're talented enough. So there seems to be a point where like you just need to get above this line. You don't have to be the best person in the room. Like there's the whole notion that there is a best person in the room is probably rubbish. Like you just need to be good enough. Since we're in quarantine, I've been consuming all kinds of media. Like,
well, I also,
and I'm thinking about it. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I don't want to forget this. I also wonder, like, for Llewellyn or anybody, like any artist, like, what is breaking through mean? Like, so in Llewellyn Davis, like, the Justin Timberlake's character and...
Jim
and what was her name?
Jean.
Jim and Jean. So they played the Gaslight on occasion.
Yeah.
And the manager were like, yeah, they always bring... They bring in the crowds. And he's like, well, it's because everybody wants to... It doesn't matter. Everybody wants to sleep with Jean. It doesn't matter. But they bring in crowds. And I'm like, well, they seem to be happy at where they are. Like, they're not looking to be like, we would need you to go to Capitol Records and record or whatever, even though Justin Timberlake does have the whatever. But they seem pleased with, like, they like going to the Gaslight. They can sell out, you know, the Gaslight. They're not looking to push anywhere else or whatever. And they're just happy with, like, that level.
Mm-hmm.
And, I wonder if it says something to like, where you're like, well, look, you may not ever get to, as an artist, you may not ever get to be like Bob Dylan famous, who we see at the end of the movie, but maybe it's okay with being Gaslight famous. And Gaslight it was a real place, and it does go on to be quite a famous spot.
Yeah, and Llewellyn Davis is based on a real life guy.
Yeah.
They use anecdotes from a real life guy who was not a loser. He was actually pretty successful. He stayed in the genre of folk music, so he never broke through to the mainstream.
Yeah.
But in that domain, he was very successful. I forgot his name. Something Van something. I should have looked it up before this. Anyway, maybe you don't have to... Maybe success on a larger scale is not the be-all and end-all. Yeah. I'm always torn by people like saying that. I'm always torn because the criticism can be leveraged to, people that never make it big are the people that often say,
yeah,
making it big is not all there is. You never hear people that are super successful actually say, yeah, I didn't need to be super successful. Ever so often you hear super successful people like go back and go, ah, success ruined me. But you know what? They would never know that if they hadn't been successful.
But I do think that there are people out there that, because I do think there are people out there that are lost to success, I guess. I don't know.
Believe there are people who genuinely define success for themselves. Like are very happy having attained what they themselves lay out as their, yeah, what is successful for them. I find that it's rare. Most people, self-definition is on the whole something a lot of people don't pay attention to in a general way,
yeah,
let alone as far as like career and livelihood go. But I find that I was a commercial actor for 8 years, and I had an agent, and she sent me to voiceovers and industrials, and I would occasionally go audition for mostly indie movies and some like bigger mainstream movies and stuff. Mm. And I would tell people had an agent, and the people that are not in the arts, like my folks and stuff, and my neighbors and things, And they would, oh, it always looked to them like it was a, I had attained some milestone and I was legit.
Yeah.
Even though I'm like, well, I was making stuff outside of my commercial gigs that actually was artistically fulfilling, but paid very little.
Yeah.
The commercial gigs at the time paid pretty well, but were selling soft tacos and phone books and you insurance
dated,
and stuff.
Like, you dated yourself with phone books, but yes.
Yeah, I know, right? Like, I was in Super Pages commercials back in the day. But I remember eventually, like, I just faded away from it. Mm-hmm. We have a really good friend who went in to, he moved to New York, worked off Broadway, then got into TV and has now made a huge impact in TV. It's fun to watch. He's an awesome dude. I love him. I love him as a person first. And he is also, on top of it, a genuinely talented dude. And he always wanted it.
Yeah.
Like, that was his goal. Like, I remember talking to him and he's like, no, I wanted to be on TV. Like, I wanted to be in movies. Like, I want to be that kind of actor. And he really knows himself. And I don't want to speak for him because I don't know. Because I also don't talk to him as much now that he's busy making TV shows and stuff. I don't know if he actually has something to say with his acting.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's important for him to have something to say.
Yeah.
I think it's important for him to act, to go through the motions of playing characters, and that he likes interesting projects and interesting shows, and he likes to make a living at it. And I don't begrudge him that at all. Like, I think that's awesome. But on the flip side, I'm like, but he doesn't have anything. Does he have something to say? He might have something to say, and I just don't know about it. Like, that's a total possibility. And it makes me think of the, like, come face to face with the dilemma of, like, well, do you have to genuinely want to express yourself and also be successful monetarily in the eyes of the greater world?
Yeah.
Because as a commercial actor, I remember thinking, I don't want to, I literally had this weird come to Jesus moment where I'm like, I just don't want to be famous on like this.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't want to pay for it. And if you're not going to pay for it, it's not going to happen. Like, I didn't want to go through years of selling soft tacos on commercials and work my way up to small TV roles in second rate, you know, sitcoms, and then hope to get a bigger role and a bigger role and then eventually make it onto TV or something.
You didn't want to Adam Driver it.
No. And the thing is, I'm like, my Adam Driver sales have already sailed.
Yeah.
Like, that boat's already...
There's no more Adam Driver.
This was in my 30s, and I obviously look like a character actor anyway.
Yeah.
And I don't mind playing character roles. I think character roles are awesome. But I'm like, I don't want to...
Yeah.
I don't want to be known in my life as a character role guy in TV.
You would be very much... Like, if had you gone this route, you would definitely be... Neighbor dad.
Oh yeah, now, especially now.
Yeah.
In my 20s and 30s, I was like Chandler Bing or somebody.
Yeah.
In fact, most of my commercial gigs were booked by people coming in without a script, and they're like, just do something funny with it. Every time I had to improvise, there's very few people in the area at the time there was who looked like me who could just make stuff up.
Yeah.
That was my only thing that set me aside from other actors. That it was me and like two other guys, and we were the only competition for ourselves. But I remember thinking, I'm like, do I want to do TV shows? Like, seriously, do I want to be on TV shows? And admittedly, this was right at the cusp of TV becoming interesting.
Yeah.
10 years later, I'm like eating my words. I'm like, TV?
You could have been on Too Hot.
That'll never have a golden age again. So
all the reality.
Yeah, but I think about that. I'm like, I think sometimes I hear your headphones again.
The Wi-Fi.
Oh, like
the Bluetooth.
Yeah, speakers. Yeah. Anyway, when I watch the movie, I think to myself, he doesn't seem to want anything. He doesn't want the path of commercial success. He doesn't want to play on demand. He doesn't want to... And when the guy's like, here's what you could do to make money, he disregards that advice.
Yeah.
If he wanted to make money, he has a skill set to do it, but he doesn't seem to want to do it. Yeah. On the other hand, when he's playing his music, it's very telling that he's not Bob Dylan. Bob right. Dylan had something to say. Like,
well, and he's such an internalized kind of like, he doesn't communicate well with personally or like on stage, and people don't connect with him. And that's in his music as well. His music is very internalized. I don't know how many songs he plays in the movie. He plays a couple of them a couple of times. He does seem to go back to it. He does play the song that he and his former
partner.
He's basically Art Garfunkel, basically, is what is what I got out of it. Like, his partner might have been a little bit more talented than him. He might have been maybe writing, not necessarily writing his partner's coattails, but like, you know, they worked. You know, but F. Murray Abraham said, he's like, get yourself a partner. You work better with a partner.
Yeah.
Like, he needs something to help him open up. And he's not, I just don't think that he comes to the realization that he has those skills to do it himself. It's not necessarily that he's not good enough. It's just that he is lacking whatever X factor it is that connects with a larger audience.
Yes. And I half agree with you. I think he connects more with people when he's singing. I think people pay attention more when he's singing, and he gets through to people more when he's singing than he does in real life.
Yeah.
But I don't think he has that X factor. Like, he's not a star.
Yeah, well, and when I kind of jokingly talk about like the American Idol and stuff, but what you do see when you watch the shows is there are a lot of talented people that try out for those shows that want to be singers and whatnot, but you do kind of see or hear the same kind of voice over and over and over. And I'm like, and it's a fine voice. I'm sure that all those people have sung national anthems or, you know, performed at like little county fairs or whatnot.
Or like with their church.
Yeah, or something like that. But it's just, you fall into the ocean of all these people who are just as talented, you know? And so, that begs the question of as an artist, what are your goals? Because if you have your heart set on being American Idol, and you're just not that good, then I'm sorry. But, you know, if you are okay with being the best singer at your church and then riding that wave of fame and popularity or whatever, then, you know, more power to you, I guess.
And if you get into the mainstream kind of thing, into the commercial world, it's called the commercial world for a reason. Are you prepared to sell stuff with your talents? Are you prepared to be exploited for other people's gain is a trade for your success.
Yeah.
Which is okay. I think in a lot of regards, that's okay. Like, I don't think that's a sacred thing or anything.
Yeah. And I don't think it's like you're either a full on artist or you're a clown. Like,
I think there's degrees.
Yeah. There's a lot of, like, you can compromise and still not feel like you've compromised your artistic integrity, but more just, you know, like,
or do both.
Yeah.
It's funny that it's the Coen brothers. One argument I read a while back was that this would be what happened if one of the Coen brothers passed on, because they're a double act. They're a duo of filmmakers. And if either Joel or Ethan passed on, what would happen to the other one? Yeah. Like, it doesn't diminish the fact that they're both awesome. One would still be awesome. It's just you need two, you know, to make it this kind of Coen brothers movie. Like, to make the kind of movies they make now, they need both of them. But if you isolated one from the other, you'd still have a great filmmaker. But you see what I'm saying? But it wouldn't be the same. They might flounder. Like, they could totally flounder. They totally might not make it. And it's telling that it's the Coen brothers, because the Coen brothers make money off their movies. Some of their movies aren't just critically, you know, renowned, but they're also like commercial successes.
Yes.
And then they still make whatever kind of movie they want. And they make it in whatever order they want.
They are kind of their own.
Yeah. Yeah. They made No Country for Old Men and then followed it up with A Serious Man, which is just usually, and this is a generalization, but a lot of time filmmakers make a successful film and then they try to segue it into a bigger, more successful film. They Taika Waititi it.
Yeah.
They don't go backwards. So, but the Coen brothers do whatever they want. And it rides the line between being artistically successful and commercially successful.
What's that? There's that line in, I think it's Clerks 2 from Kevin Smith, where Ben Affleck and Matt Damon are talking about how they do one for the one money and then one independent. One money and one independent. They go back and forth on the films.
Yeah. So I think that's possible. I think it's totally possible. I see in Llewyn Davis also, because he doesn't play the game, quote unquote, there's like defiance in that and rebellion in that, but also foolhardiness in that. And when I first saw the movie, I saw that in myself. Not so much nowadays, like not so much on the second viewing. I'm a different person than I was in 2014, but in 2014, I do remember back going, yeah, I stand with Llewyn Davis. I refuse to be exploited. I refuse to sell out. I refuse to, the irony being I had to work really hard to even get to the point where I could sell out.
Yeah.
But now I'm like, no, is it selling out if you can also still make what you want and the way you want it and say what you want to say?
I don't think so, but I think that's a young person's take as well.
I think you're right too. So I think definitely you're right.
You know, that's a young person's like
all or nothing.
Yeah, it's all or nothing. They don't see the grays in between. And as you get older, you're like, it doesn't. You understand that the integrity of what you want to say can be layered in. You know, maybe you at this point your brain slows down, or you just get skilled enough to be able to be like, I know how to like weave what I want to say into this other thing. Or
yeah, that's a big part of it. I think a huge part of it is if you genuinely get the skill set, you don't wear it on your sleeve anymore.
Yeah,
you don't have anything to prove once it's provable.
Yeah,
once you get to the point where you're good enough. And then some, you stop trying to prove to everybody else around you that you're good enough. And you stop being bothered that people don't pick up on it.
Right.
That's the other thing. I used to ironically be less skilled, but more frustrated that people didn't pick up on what skills I had. And ironically, as I've gotten older, the opposite. Like I am now much more comfortable creating stuff for the stage and much better playwright than I used to be.
Yeah.
And much more comfortable in just the the making of stuff.
Yeah.
And my skill set. I know where my limits are, and I'm very acutely aware of all the stuff I don't know. and am okay, and not in a hurry to learn it.
Yeah.
And enjoying the process of it much more. And I'm not bothered as much. There's a tinge here and there, but I'm definitely not as much as I was when I was younger. I'm not bothered by people. Like, I don't mind being introduced to people and them having no idea who I am or what I'm capable of. In fact, I've grown to delight in demonstrating who I am in different situations where I like coming out of nowhere. Like, I used to want the respect before I earned it.
Yeah.
And now I don't mind earning it. Like, I don't mind that at all. And Llewyn Davis reminds me of somebody who's will never get to the point.
Yeah, it just reminds me, the movie reminds me of a young artist who is just uncompromising in a bad way.
Yeah, not compromising when you need to compromise.
Yeah, exactly.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Part of connection is compromise.
Yeah. It's just like a relationship.
Yeah, yeah. So, anyway, hey, thanks for recording this with me, Jeff. Well,
thanks for having me over. It was lovely visiting this podcast.
Well, thanks. We'll have Jeff back again in the future. As always, feel free to visit the website on WordPress, Cultivated Playwright, and see the show notes. You can check me out at bradmcintyre.com. There's links to my Instagram and Tumblr and all that kind of stuff as well on that. And always, I appreciate you listening. Thanks. Bye-bye.